It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, an innovative program in Brown County aims to help young people appreciate where their food comes from and gives them a way to learn about business firsthand.
But first, President Trump addressed Congress last night for the first time during his tenure in the White House. And many commentators say he struck a calmer, more positive tone than he has in previous speeches.
In his address, he talked about health care, national security, immigration, education, and other issues on the table for federal lawmakers.
Anna Edgerton joins us now. She's a reporter for Bloomberg News, where she covers congressional politics. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, so as we reference there, the big headline from last night seems to be that President Trump gave a much more measured, positive speech than he's given before. How would you describe the tone?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think he rose to the occasion and it was a pretty well-received speech. He definitely, you know, respected the moment. He stood up in the front of the Congress addressing all of these legislators, and he had a more positive message, a more optimistic vision. And I think he fulfilled the goal that he had for the night to present himself as the president of the United States and as the leader that this country needs.
So the tenor of the speech was different than we've seen before from President Trump. But what about the nuts and bolts, the policy and the agenda goals that he's laid out?
Well, the substance wasn't so different. I mean, he did stick to his campaign pledges, mentioning the wall and some tax reform. He was a little short on details, which was not totally unexpected. Joint address to Congress is not necessarily the place to lay out specific policy proposals, but I think there were some details lacking that Republican lawmakers, markets, investors, and the American people are probably going to be looking for in the next few weeks.
Specifically, what details struck you as being missing from the speech last night?
Well, for example, talking about the repeal and replacement of Obamacare, he kind of tiptoed close to some of the proposals that have been discussed by Republicans in the House and the Senate, but he didn't get behind a specific proposal. And I think at some point there will be need to be some guidance from the White House on which direction to go with that. Also with tax reform, he mentioned the need for some kind of adjustment to get American companies on a level playing field with foreign companies, but he didn't fully endorse the plan put forth by House Speaker Paul Ryan, and I think there'll be a lot of people watching to see where President Trump comes down on some of those issues.
Well, you mentioned health care. Let's listen to the president in his own words from last night.
Mandating every American to buy government-approved health insurance was never the right solution for our country. The way to make health insurance available to everyone is to lower the cost of health insurance, and that is what we are going to do.
And Anna, you said not a lot of specifics there, but what do we know about what kind of support President Trump has for what we do know about the plan and his goals for it so far?
Well, I think the White House and Republicans in the House and in the Senate are united behind the principles of health care reform, that they want to have a more patient-centered system. They would probably even give more freedom to the states to choose what's best for each state. But the problem is now peeling back the layers of Obamacare that have been the law of the land for 6-7 years and trying to get a transition that will be smooth enough to not disrupt insurance markets and to not leave millions of people uninsured. So I think that transition is going to be not an easy thing to iron out. And I think there needs to be very specific proposals that the White House will have to probably at some point be a bit more explicit about what direction they want that to go in.
Does it look likely that he'll face any strong headwinds from within his own party?
It depends on where he comes out on some of the specific policy issues. The House Republicans, for example, are divided on Medicaid expansion and what to do with the states that chose to expand Medicaid and the states that didn't. So there's going to be some sparring over the specific details, and at some point the president will have to wade into those battles and that's where he could see some pushback, but could also use his position as the president to help push forward the policy proposals that will ultimately become legislation.
We're talking with Anna Edgerton right now with Bloomberg News, talking about President Trump's speech before Congress last night. And Anna, the president has been criticized for being slow to denounce violence and threats aimed at Muslims and Jews and other minority groups. And last night, though, he made a strong statement about those issues, calling for unity and tolerance. Will that be enough for his critics?
Well, that was one of the first topics that he touched on, so you could see it was definitely a priority in his speech last night. I think it will address some of the criticism that he had been slow to respond to that kind of attack, but it's going to have to be a constant thing as we, you know, see news reports of attacks on different minority groups. There's going to be a constant demand for the president to respond and to denounce that kind of interaction in American public life.
And looking at comments about education made last night, President Trump talked about education reform. Here's what he had to say.
Our children will grow up in a nation of miracles. But to achieve this future, we must enrich the mind and the souls of every American child. Education is the civil rights issue of our time. I am calling upon members of both parties to pass an education bill that funds school choice for disadvantaged youth, including millions of African American and Latino children.
So education, the president says, is the civil rights issue of our time, calling for school choice. What did Congress make of those remarks?
Yeah, I think that was a really important point for him to make. He hadn't spent much time speaking about education besides his references to Betsy DeVos, his new education secretary, when she was nominated for her cabinet position. So I think it was important for him to come back to this issue, spend some time talking about it, really emphasize it as an important point in the speech. And he said all the right things for Republicans in Congress. Republicans generally support more choice for the states, more choice for individual families. And as long as they can come up with their proposals that will fulfill those kind of broad policy ideals, I think that's what the president will be looking for and what the Republican voters will probably be looking for as well.
We're talking with Anna Edgerton right now. She's a reporter with Bloomberg News, and she's with us to talk about the president's first congressional address last night.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think about the president's speech last night? Do you have thoughts on any of the particular priorities he talked about on education, healthcare, security, immigration? If you're a fan of the president, if you've been supporting him, did you miss the more aggressive tone? If you had your doubts about the president, did this relieve those at all? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a bit. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Anna Edgerton from Bloomberg News. She's with us to talk about President Trump's first congressional address last night.
And we'd like to hear from you. What takeaways did you have from the president's speech? What did you think about the more measured tone and the positivity that came out of it? And what about the policy proposals? Call us at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Colin joining us in Wausau. Colin, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I love your program and
thank
public
you.
Radio. So thank you for what you guys do.
Appreciate that. What did you want to add, Colin?
And I'm not a Trump supporter, so maybe this is nitpicky or this is, you know, kind of looking for problems or issues. But what really burned me was the buy American, hire American comment. My wife has a green card. She comes from Thailand. I was in the Peace Corps. That's where I met her. And she has a nursing background with a master's degree. So that means don't hire her. And then on the flip side, if we move back to Thailand, does that mean the Thai government should go buy Thai and only hire Thai? And so that's where that American first, and I don't know, it really burned me, because I get to buy local, buy American, but she has legal status to be here, and she should be hired for the skills that she can offer in any workplace.
Colin, thank you for calling. Appreciate that. And Anna, that America First language was there. The nationalist tone, the strand of it, was still there last night. And Colin is saying that leave some people out of the equation here. What do you think about that aspect?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And thanks, Colin, for that. I think the America First, you know, buy American, hire American rhetoric plays really well with the American electorate. You know, most people who vote are citizens. But I think, you know, it risks missing the point that immigrants do contribute a lot to our economy and to our country and to the social fabric of the United States of America. And also, if you're going to support free market principles, as most Republicans profess to do, the idea that you would limit your hiring or your business practices by where whatever qualified person comes from goes a little bit against that. So I think it's going to be an interesting theme that we'll see play out. You know, obviously it was a big element of the campaign and definitely something that we'll see President Trump reacting to and maybe even developing those ideas a little bit more once they get it put into practice in the real world.
Colin, again, thanks for the call. We go next to Ian in Door County. Ian, hi.
Hey, how you doing, guys? Hope everybody's having a good day.
Doing well, thanks. What did you want to throw into the conversation?
Well, I just wanted to make one little mention that, you know, really in terms of the message that Trump was putting out last night, it was no different than the same message he's delivered, you know, over the entire campaign as well as into the first 2 months here of his presidency. More so, the reason why it's having such successful response is that the demeanor of it was something that we've seen in a different tone from him. But the message really was nothing different than he had been delivering all along. And I'll take your comments off air.
Ian, thanks for that. And Anna, people have been commenting that, you know, there was speculation after last night that this was the pivot point that some politics watchers have been looking for, saying this could be the turn to a different type of president. And Ian saying, this is the same Donald Trump that we've seen. The tone was different, but the content was the same.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't think the tone is going to get him, that the shift in tone is going to get him much more than a temporary bump in approval ratings or in kind of acceptance from maybe more mainstream voters and more mainstream politicians. And I think the substance was very similar to what we saw in the campaign. But tone matters, and the way that you present it to the American people and the way that you present it to Congress will influence how far President Trump can advance his ideas. So I think that's going to be an important place to watch, especially since we were kind of conditioned to expect explosive displays of emotion or, you know, kind of off-script comments from President Trump. To see him in a more measured, kind of restrained environment makes us wonder what we're going to see from here on out, if he'll keep that up or if he'll return to his same old improvisational self.
And on the other hand, as you said, tone matters. The speech was billed by Trump supporters going in as something that would be kind of Reagan-esque in tone. Do you think it hit that mark?
Yeah, and I think the setting helped as well. I mean, you had you're in the Congress, in the Capitol building, with all of the, you know, the whole legislative body in front of you. And so that the setting helped create this kind of presidential atmosphere. I think in order to really set a strong agenda that kind of inspires the same confidence that as President Reagan, it's going to need to have a bit more meat on the bones of some of the policy proposals, you know, not necessarily getting to specific numbers, but giving a bit more guidance to the troops that are going to carry out his legislative agenda.
Let's take another call here. We've got Tom with us in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I thought last night was it was definite improvement, but let's face it, the bar is pretty low. All he had to do was to not act like a maniac, and all of a sudden we're comparing him to Ronald Reagan. The things that I was missing was any talk of climate change, Social Security, Medicare, and even income inequality and Glass-Steagall, which were all things that he was running on in his platform, but unfortunately we didn't see any of that last night. And after pretty much disrespecting a Gold Star family, now we see a war widow standing with a standing ovation for 4 minutes. Some might see that as patriotic. I see it as very exploitive.
Tom, thanks a lot. Yeah, you brought a lot of issues there. Tom Singh has a lot of stuff that he thought was remarkable for not being in the speech, and he's also pointing to the moment with the widow yesterday, which was hailed by some people as a high point. Tom saw it as exploitive. What did you think, Anna?
Yeah, that's a good point, Tom. You mentioned some of the stuff that wasn't in there. I don't catch up to that list. You know, he didn't mention Russia a single time. I think the Medicare and Social Security is an interesting space to watch going forward because it wasn't included. Entitlement reform wasn't included in his budget that's been presented this week. And that's something that Speaker Ryan and a bunch of the House Republicans have advocated pretty strongly in the past. So seeing what Congress ends up doing with entitlement reform will be an interesting potential conflict to keep an eye out for. For the tribute to the fallen Navy SEAL and his widow that was there, it was such an emotional moment. It's you know, it's possible to see that as cynical, but you know, I think we also have to respect the life that was given for the defense of the United States, although there's some debate over how effective that mission actually was. But, you know, it was an emotional moment. She made a great sacrifice with her fallen husband as a Navy SEAL. And, you know, it is what it is. It's a sacrifice you have to respect. Whether or not it was done for political gain on Trump's part, you know, well, I think we have to leave it at that.
Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course.
That was Anna Edgerton, a reporter with Bloomberg News. She joined us there to talk about President Trump's speech in front of Congress last night.
Wisconsin's mix of cold winters and hot summers puts stress on its highways, but nothing damages roads more than heavy trucks. And yet, at a time when road conditions are getting worse in Wisconsin, state lawmakers have been reluctant to punish overweight trucks that do the most damage. In our ongoing series on transportation funding in Wisconsin, Sean Johnson reports.
Fewer than 100 state patrol officers are responsible for enforcing weight limits on Wisconsin highways. Sergeant Jeremiah Johnson is one of them.
The weight limits are there to protect the infrastructure of the roadways. The heavier the vehicle, the more damage it does.
Johnson and other highway inspectors are focused on commercial trucks or semi-trucks. Depending on how much companies pay the state in vehicle registration fees, trucks can weigh up to 80,000 pounds. The state weighs trucks at 13 weigh stations. It also uses several weigh-in motion scales. These combine cameras and metal plates built into the pavement to weigh trucks while they're driving. Inspectors patrolling Wisconsin's roads can also pull over trucks, and Johnson's doing that now. Johnson says most truck drivers follow the law, and no inspections are just a part of doing business. That's the way this stop unfolds. Johnson shouts instructions to the driver as he inspects the truck, including its lights and brakes.
Left turn signal. Right. Okay, four ways. Brake. Good.
The truck's in good shape and shows no sign of being overweight, so there's no need for Johnson to break out portable scales or escort the truck to a weigh station. Once he's done, Johnson checks his laptop to see what he missed. Several trucks passed the weigh-in motion scales just down the road while he was busy. Three of them weighed more than the 80,000-pound legal limit.
It's frustrating, but you can't really let it get to you. I mean, I can only do so much, and us as an agency, there's only so much you can do with the personnel that you have. And it's just, you can't get them all, but you can do the best you can with what you have.
In the case of the Wisconsin State Patrol's highway inspectors, that's meant doing the job with fewer people. While the agency's scale technology has dramatically improved, the number of highway inspectors on the road today is smaller than a decade ago, even though the number of heavy trucks has grown. The Department of Transportation proposed adding inspectors a few years ago, citing an internal study that showed overweight trucks cause $41 million in pavement damage annually in Wisconsin. Republicans on the legislature's budget committee rejected the plan, and soon after, the full legislature passed bills allowing farm equipment on roads that's even heavier, up to 92,000 pounds. Ben Jordan is the director of the Transportation Information Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's College of Engineering. Jordan teaches local governments how to build and maintain roads. Jordan says every heavy truck causes damage, much more than cars.
Maybe there are 50,000 vehicles traveling on the interstate in a day. Now, the DOT says 35% of those are trucks. One of those trucks would do the same damage to that highway as 9,600 cars.
Some local governments complain their roads have been damaged to the point that they're unsafe at highway speeds. And there are other safety concerns. At the Beloit Way Station, Highway Inspector Derek Schutte is examining a semi-trailer when he spots a problem.
Release! So this truck's out of service for brakes.
Three of this truck's 10 brakes don't work, which means the driver has to park it until it's fixed or towed. Schutte says he's seen enough examples like this that it's changed the way he drives.
I will tell you when I'm driving either in my squad car or in my personal vehicle, if I'm in and around a semi, it's either passing it to get around it, or I'm pretty far off.
Cars have to coexist with semis in a state and a country where the economy is built around trucking. But all those heavy trucks come with trade-offs. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we find out how young people in Brown County are learning how to both grow and sell their own vegetables. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. Another thank you to everyone who pledged during our pledge drive last week. You helped us raise more than $450,000 over the course of that drive. Thank you so much for your support. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a little bit, we'll ask you to share your favorite biographies and memoirs of all time.
First, teens and tweens in Brown County had a unique opportunity last summer to gain job and business skills by running their own farmers market stands. UW Extension in Brown County teamed up with the Boys and Girls Club of Green Bay for the market program, hoping to raise food and the next generation of entrepreneurs.
Margaret Franchino joins us now. She's the Community Garden Coordinator for UW Extension Brown County. Margaret, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with a problem you were trying to help solve with this program, a decline in teen summer employment. What's been happening?
Yeah, absolutely. So in recent years, we've seen really a decline in the number of teens who have summer jobs. And just overall, there's such an advantage to work experience. We found there's a lot of research showing that teens who have work experience as young adults really succeed more later on in life. And so we want to be able to address that problem and kind of fill a gap by having a program giving teens work experience.
And it's not just hoping to train people to have jobs in the future, as I understand it. You're also responding to some local planning studies saying, hey, we need not just workers, but future entrepreneurs in Brown County.
Yes. So the 2011 Life Study is a well-known study in this part of the county. And they identified growing entrepreneurs as one of the top priorities, different county leaders did. And so we're really excited to be able to help with that with the teen market program.
Well, let's get our hands dirty and talk about what the kids actually did in this program. It started in part with having their own garden plots, right?
Yes. Yeah, so they had their own garden plot and they were completely responsible for it. So they planted and then throughout the summer had to weed, water, take care of it, and then eventually harvest at the end of the summer. So it was great hands-on experience for them.
And is this through the UW Extension Community Gardens that you work with?
Yes, so they had some gardens on site, and then also we have a community garden about a half mile down the road from the Boys and Girls Club, so they could just walk down and tend to that garden as well.
And are these kids who grew up with gardens or farms, or was this new to a lot of them?
You know, it really depended on the kid. There are some that had some experience, but there are some it was completely new for, and so it was great that they actually got to have the hands-on experience. It really connects them to their food to have the experience of growing it.
And then through the summer, as I understand it, they weren't just doing this gardening. They did a lot of, I guess, market research in a way. What kind of stuff did they do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we tried to kind of make it really multifaceted, have a lot of different experiences drawn in. So different things we did, we went on field trips. So they went to the downtown Green Bay farmers market, and then they used that experience to interview vendors at the farmers market to kind of gain their experience to use in their own experience having their own farmers market stall. They also went to a local CSA, the Twin Elms Gardens. They went and toured there as well to see another aspect of production. And then they also had some different classes from different experts who came in. So UW Extension horticulture expert educator came in and did a horticulture lesson. We had a financial planning lesson from a different Extension employee. So we really tried to make it multifaceted, have lots of different experiences come in. And then also they did some of their own research and planning for the program. So they researched, you know, what tent and what coolers and what supplies should we buy, things like that. So it really gave them a wide variety of opportunities and experiences.
It sounds like, a degree in a business school with a market, a garden on the side.
Yes.
So how did the kids take to this? Was this something, having the actual hands-on part of it, did that make the learning part of it more fun?
I think so, yes. I think we did surveys at the end, and we had reports throughout, and what we heard over and over again was that the hands-on experience was really the part that mattered to the kids, and really the part that made them want to come back and do more over and over.
Now let's talk about the kids themselves. Who was participating in this program?
Mm-hmm. So it was participants at the Boys and Girls Club, members there. So we mostly worked with the tween population, so kind of average age of 11, 12-ish. So probably too young to get a summer job themselves, so not an older teen, but old enough to be able to gain that job experience and really be able to apply that in a few years down the road.
And was this last summer the first time you've done this?
It was. It was our pilot year last year. So we're planning on doing it again in 2017, but definitely applying some lessons that we learned in 2016.
How many kids were on board the first time around?
Yeah, it depended on the week. With summer, it's hard with scheduling, things like that. But between 5 and 10 usually per week came to the program.
Yeah, and what were some of the lessons you learned from the pilot program?
Yeah, so one thing that we kind of struggled with, which I'm sure every gardening program struggles with, is the weather. It was kind of against us this year. We had, I think, 12 different dates that we met, and 8 of them it rained. So we had to struggle with that a little bit. Besides that, I think working with kids in the summer, just trying to keep things fun and lively, you know, not have kind of the traditional classroom experience, but more being out hands-on, I think, was really a good experience for them.
Now, they were doing the garden. They were maintaining this garden throughout the summer. The grand finale, it sounds like, was they actually... Did they go to an existing farmer's market, or did they kind of run their own farmer's market?
They ran their own farmer's market.
Okay.
So we talked with the Boys and Girls Club, our partner in this, and they thought that having it on site would be a great opportunity. So we had a tent set up in front of the Boys and Girls Club, and then they were able to sell to parents and people passing by. So it was great that they got to show parents what they'd been working on all summer and then other people in the community as well.
And what kind of produce was available here that the kids grew?
All different. Just kind of the typical tomatoes, beans, cucumbers, onions, lettuce, all different things. We had a good season, so they got a lot of produce out.
Margaret Franchino is with us. She's the Community Garden Coordinator for the University of Wisconsin Extension, Brown County, talking about a program. It was a pilot last year, coming back next year. Kids 11 and 12 years old grew their own crops, their own garden, and ended up holding their own farmer's market, got a lot of business advice along the way. So, Margaret, let's talk about lessons learned by the kids. What kind of skills did you see them taking out of this?
Yeah, so really a wide range of skills. We focused on nutrition in some lessons. So we talked about, you know, how do you read a food label? How do you make a healthy snack? Things like that. Also business skills. We had them interview different vendors at the farmers market and then kind of get skills on how to relate to customers, how to advertise. A couple of them got to be on the news advertising the market, so that was a great experience for them. Besides that, horticulture skills, the hands-on growing your own food, that's something you can carry with you throughout life, which is wonderful. Some financial management skills, when we had an extension educator come in and talk about that. So really a wide range there.
Are you looking to make it bigger next summer?
That's the goal. With programming this year, we only met once a week, and our goal is to do twice a week this year. Just we found that it was hard to squeeze everything in the lessons, then also tending to the garden. So we're hoping that. One other thing we're hoping to do this year is add a salsa making component. So just kind of bringing it to the next level, to selling the produce and then also preparing the produce and selling that as well.
And kind of teaching the whole value-added concept to the kids along
Correct.
The way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What kind of planning is going on for your community garden there in general right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So we actually send out our community garden registration packets in February to see who's coming back from year to year, and then we get started registering new gardeners as well. So things are pretty busy throughout the year, actually. Right now, also a lot of grant writing, trying to figure out funding and programming for the next season.
How, staying with community gardening for a moment, we'll bring the kids back in a minute,
okay.
But how many people participate in community gardening in Brown County?
Yes, so we have 10 gardens throughout the county, and we have 308 garden plots, and among those, we have 200 gardening families, so some have more than one plot, just depending on the family.
And is that something that's been growing over the years?
It has. So the program started in 1996, and it started really small, just one site with 12 garden plots,
wow.
And now we've expanded to the 10 sites, so it's really grown, and we've really seen an increase in interest in gardening in recent years, and still, every year we ask our gardeners, you know, is this a good amount of space, or do you need more space to garden? And every year they ask for more. So we're still growing and looking to grow into the future.
And do you see a lot of kids participating with their families in these?
Yes, it's a wonderful activity. We actually ask all of our gardeners, do you spend more time with your family because you garden? We do a survey at the end of the season. And one of the things that they always come back and say is, yes, you know, this was a great experience with our kids to get to spend time all together.
And do you do other partnerships at the community garden like this one we've been talking about with the Boys and Girls Club?
Yes, we also partner with the City of Green Bay. We do some children's education. So when we started the Teen Farmers Market program, that was kind of to fill a gap that we realized that we didn't have any programming for older kids. But we do programming with younger kids with the City of Green Bay. And then also we partner with New Leaf Foods to do a Green Bay Garden Blitz program. And so that's another way to increase gardening in the area. So we build 4 feet by 8 feet raised garden beds and then sell them and distribute them with volunteers throughout the community over the course of one weekend in May.
Now, getting back to the program with the kids, coming back, as you said, next year, do you see this actually working for the goal intended to getting these kids these job skills and meeting those needs that you mentioned in that economic evaluation from a few years back?
I really think so. I mean, there's so much research to show that hands-on experience is really important. And so they're getting the experience that they wouldn't have otherwise, talking with customers, planning, getting to, kind of follow a project from start to finish. So I think that they'll really be able to apply that later on in life.
Now, my gut guess would be that you're a pretty handy gardener yourself. Is that fair to say?
I've been gardening since I was a kid, yeah.
Okay. And do you? Is it fun for you being able to work with kids? As you said, some of them, this is first-time gardening, teaching them from the ground up, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm. No, it's really fun to get to see their experience, or their first experience being in the garden. Sometimes they have such a wide range of growing experience. So some haven't ever gardened before and, you know, don't know that a cucumber grows in a certain way or that a beet grows under the ground, things like that. So it's really fun to get to see their first growing experience.
And at the end result, are the kids trying maybe some vegetables they've never tried or wanted to try before?
Absolutely. No, there's a lot of research out there, and we've just seen firsthand experience that when kids grow their own food, they're definitely more willing to try it and then eat it in the long run.
And if your colleagues around the state are thinking, hey, this is a good idea, how would you recommend they get started on stealing the idea? Or borrowing, I guess we could say.
Yes. No, I'd be happy to talk with anyone through the Brown County. You know, I actually kind of borrowed the idea from Iron County. They have a similar program up there as well. Slightly different with younger kids a bit, but we, you know, would be happy to have it spread throughout the state. So,
Margaret, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That was Margaret Franchino, Community Garden Coordinator for the University of Wisconsin Extension Brown County, talking about a youth farmers market program aimed at teaching job and business skills to local youth. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later on, Attorney General Jeff Sessions gave his first major speech yesterday. We'll hear about what he had to say.
First two highly anticipated books are officially in the works. It was announced yesterday that former President Barack Obama and former First Lady Michelle Obama have both signed major book deals with Penguin Random House. They'll reflect on the Obama's White House years. Additional details like titles and release dates are not yet available.
That got us thinking, though, about biographies and memoirs and some of our favorites throughout the years. Also got us talking about some of the people throughout history that we'd love to read more about.
Now it is your turn. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Do you read biographies, autobiographies, and memoirs? Do you have a favorite? What's the best one you've read? Maybe one you go back to? Or is there someone throughout history, famous or less so, who you'd like to read more about? Whose book would you like to read, whether it exists or not? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Bonnie joining us in Milwaukee. Bonnie, hi.
Hi. Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I was just so inspired by what you just said, and learning about the future books that were coming out from President Obama and Michelle Obama. And, you asked the question if we had an opportunity to choose someone that we would want to learn more about. I would have to say I would continue as a local author writing about the legacy of my mother. Mm-hmm. I recently, in fact, this is my second edition, I titled the book Mama Said, and the foundation of the book, or the primary messages that our mothers throughout our years of growing up, they teach us these life lessons, and what I call these lessons are pearls of wisdom. And so I continue to be inspired by my mother. She continues to influence me in everything that I do. She was just ahead of her time prior to her passing away about 15 years ago. So if I had an opportunity to write my third book, it would still be in the memory of my mother.
Mm. Oh, wonderful, Bonnie. Thank you. And Bonnie's exploring the family tree and the legacies within our families. I think that's a wonderful way to go. And those are things that future generations are going to look back on and be so glad to have those accounts written down for them.
And if there's a genealogist in the further down in the family tree, they're going to love to come across that book, I promise. Thanks for that call, Bonnie, at 800-642-1234, asking for your favorite biographies, autobiographies, and memoirs. We'll go next to Alan in Richland Center. Alan, hi.
Hi. I was just calling about two books that I liked was the autobiographies of, first off, General Grant, U.S. Grant, you know.
Uh-huh.
Great book. It's interesting to hear, you know, from when he was like a cadet and going through all that and some of the Civil War individuals that he knew before the Civil War and all those things. So that's a really interesting book, but also the autobiography of Alan Pinkerton.
Pinkerton wrote an autobiography? I didn't know that.
Yes, I believe it was an autobiography. Could be the biography.
Okay, gotcha.
I'm pretty sure. I can never get the two names correct.
So, and he's the guy who founded the Pinkertons, this detective slash sometimes hired muscle agency, depending on who you're talking to.
Right, right. And so those two books were great and interesting. I'd highly recommend them.
Alan, thanks so much. And I'm going on this trip to Washington before long, so I'm looking at presidential biographies a little more than I might usually. I listened to H.W. Brand's FDR biography, Traitor to His Class, and the Ulysses S. Grant autobiography is on my list. That's one I should probably read before April, I think. Thank you so much, Alan.
Thanks for that, Alan. And we go next to Anita in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Anita, hi.
Hi. It's with great joy that I happily recommend this book. It is called No Place for a Lady, and it is not maybe the one that is all over the Internet. It's not a romance novel like that one is. This one is an older book, and it is the adventurous women travelers in the 17th and 19th centuries.
Oh, wow.
Wow, that sounds interesting.
It is so grandly interesting, and it is by Barbara Hodgson. She's compiled these memoirs, and, you know, it had some of these women, the way they traveled, were dressed as men, and they would be, you know, there were no hotels going across the deserts in the Middle East, so they stayed in harems.
Oh,
and
wow.
There was a woman writer who traveled up through Canada and had a lover in one area and a husband in the other, and the only way that you could travel, there were no roads, was on the rivers. And there's just so much adventure, and some of these women, it has a lot of pictures where it's, you know, sketches and things. Where
it sounds like lots of wonderful stories chalked in that book, and that one was called No Place for a Lady.
Yeah, and Michelle Good sitting across the board says she'll maybe check that one out for a future chapter a day, so stay tuned. No promises there, but thank you so much, Anita. Taking your calls for best memoirs, biographies, and autobiographies at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Monique in Racine. Monique, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to share with us?
So there's one of the first books I ever read was Lucille Ball's autobiography called Love, Lucy. As a kid, I grew up watching TV Land and watching shows, and her book is amazing. It's really neat to see how she got her character. And the second one I wanted to talk about was Stephen King's book called On Writing. And I really enjoyed that because you get to see a sense of humor in it. He's a really funny guy. So those two I would recommend definitely for autobiographies.
Lucille Ball and Stephen King. Monique, thank you so much. They both had a very different artistic output, but but yeah, they'd both be interesting characters.
Yeah, really interesting suggestions there at different ends of the spectrum. Monique, thanks a lot for that. And another caller here from Colin in La Crosse. Colin, hi.
Hi there. There's a book that I always return to. I've read it a couple of times. I really enjoy it. It's by Andrew Schwab, and it's called It's All Downhill From Here. And it's a collection of stories from his time playing with the rock band Project 86. And it's not full of drug and alcohol stories so much as just hijinks on the road. Like they talk about their worst gig ever and stuff like that. It's a really interesting read.
Oh, that sounds fun, Colin. Thanks for that. I mean, there's so many rocker memoirs out there. Bruce Springsteen, Keith Richards. And it might be fun to get the perspective of, you know, just an ordinary band on the road.
Yeah, and it's not the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but the mundane pitfalls of life on the road. That sounds fun. I wanted to share, we asked around a WPR for some favorites. Elisa Nalbandian in Milwaukee recommends Dolly Parton's autobiography, Dolly, My Life and Other Unfinished Business. A lot of Dolly Parton fans around here.
I kind of want to read that. That sounds good.
And Dave Potraz, the Mark Twain autobiography, and Dave reminds us the remarkable thing, Twain directed that it not be published until 100 years after his death. So I remember it was a big deal when these came out after being sealed up for a century.
I didn't know that story. So that's something widely known. He wanted people to sit on it.
I remember
it
was in the news back when it came out. Yeah, I guess anybody he talked about, he wanted to make sure they were safely dead before his autobiography came out.
Well, and Dean Kallenbach from Eau Claire says, every Wisconsinite should read When Pride Still Mattered, the Vince Lombardi biography by David Marinus. Incredibly well-researched, incredible stories. A couple good ones there.
Yeah, a lot of good ones. And I'll say this is a category I've looked at reading and audiobooking more in, is historical biographies and autobiographies. So thank you to our callers for all the suggestions. And you can keep them coming over on the Central Time Facebook page. If there's an autobiography, biography, or memoir that you've read, would recommend, want to share, share it over there. Or if there's something you want to write a biography or autobiography on, let us know there too. Central Time Facebook page.
One of the country's most famous national parks turned 145 years old today. Yellowstone National Park became a national park on this day in 1872.
Ulysses S. Grant, we just heard about him, he signed a bill protecting the lands of Yellowstone, and the nation's first national park was born.
Back in 2013, the park collaborated with Acoustic Atlas at Montana State University to record the sounds of Yellowstone. Huffington Post is sharing some of those sounds today on the park's anniversary.
It's almost like being there. You can imagine yourself in Yellowstone. We'll give a listen to some of them. Here's the sound of some of Yellowstone's most iconic residents, the grizzly bears.
Kind of spine-chilling, even on a recording there.
Smarter than the average bear, though.
I guess so. And you may also remember that Yellowstone, I think this is true, is basically a park on top of a super volcano. And here's a sound of gases as they vent into a pool of wet clay known as a mud pot.
And I think we've got time to hit the sounds of Old Faithful. Go out with that here on Central Time.